of AAL, NPC, and MH. Council, you will each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would ask when you come to the podium, please introduce yourself and let us know who you're representing. This matter is being recorded, so please only refer to the parties as mother, father, child. And so there is some confidentiality in these proceedings. And with that reminder, then, I think we can proceed if the appellant is ready. You may approach the podium.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Dara Newson, and I represent the appellant in this matter. I raised several arguments in the brief. I'm going to begin with the arguments that are at the end of the brief, which is that as a matter of law, father's parental rights cannot be terminated pursuant to Minnesota Statute 260C.301, Subdivision 1, Subpart B, Subpart 2, or Subdivision 1, Subpart B, Subpart 5, as a matter of law. I will first address Subdivision 1B2. In Chosa, the court found that the trial court must make clear and specific findings conforming to the statutory requirements. In Minnesota Statute 260C.301, Subdivision 1B2, the statutory requirements are as follows. The parent has substantially, continuously, or repeatedly refused or neglected to comply with the duties imposed upon that parent and child relationship. And the parent is physically and financially able to comply with those duties. And specific to this case, because there are two parts of the third, reasonable efforts by the social services agency have failed to correct the conditions that formed the basis of the petition. What is clear in this case is that the petition, which initiated the child in need of protection or services case, contains no allegations as to father. And in fact, that has been conceded throughout the case.
Well, can I ask you this? I mean, usually at the initiation of any CHIPS action, there's an admit-deny hearing. Was the father present at that hearing?
Correct. The father was not notified of the EPC, but he did attend the admit-deny hearing. His rights were not reviewed with him at that hearing. The county attorney who represented the agency and the CHIPS explained to father, I understand that the allegations in this petition are facts that pertain to mother, but do you agree, based on those facts, that your son is a child in need of protection or services? Did not make an admission, but he did agree. Father in this case
agreed that mother's actions
correct
made the CHIPS involvement necessary.
That is correct, and that is how that inquiry was couched to him.
Was he ever advised that he had a right to an attorney?
He was not. His rights, he came into the case as a participant, and he retained a participant status throughout the case. I think it's important for this court to know this is a 24-year-old man.
We're very familiar with the facts. We understand how all that rolled out.
Okay.
So you're saying that this CHIPS petition didn't name him as a party?
Correct. He was not a party in that.
He came in as a observer or participant?
A participant. In child protection, parents come into the case, custodial parents come into the case as parties. Non-custodial parents come into the case as participants.
So there was nothing in the CHIPS petition adjudication that suggested that the child was in need of protection of services by reason of him.
Correct.
Well, can I ask you, because the child was taken out of the home, right?
Correct.
And usually there's an effort made, at least in all the CHIPS cases I presided over, to place the child with a relative. Was any attempt made to place this child with the father or the maternal grandmother, or the paternal grandmother?
Correct. The logic and the reasoning and the transcripts of the hearings of the child protection case reflect that the reason father was not considered for placement was for the purpose of working on reunification with mother.
And the plan was designed, the reasonable efforts were focused on mother services and having mother step up and resume parenting.
That's correct.
Ultimately, the father's home with his mother in Michigan was approved for placement, wasn't it?
It was. The request for that home study, which I argue is actually the assessment required under the statute for non-custodial parents in this case, was not requested until July of 2018, more than 7 months into the case. The results were made available in October of 2018, which found that the father and who lived with his mother, was there was no barrier to placement with him. That recommendation was disregarded. By that time, mother terminated her parental rights at the end of November. They had already proceeded.
So what's the timetable then, if you can lay it out for us, as far as reasonable efforts that the county engaged in as far as having the child with him?
My argument is there are none.
They did arrange some Skype phone calls.
They
offered a send of money to get him here.
I think one of the things with regards to having him come here for a visit, the agency did encourage that to happen. There is clearly a rift in communications between the social worker and a father. I would offer that my review of the records, it's like the social worker speaking French and father speaking Spanish. He felt the child should come there, of course, and he said, I can't get there. I'm working all the time, so I don't have the time to make the trip. And there was a period when he was unemployed, he didn't have the money to make the trip.
When I know that there's a reference in the briefing that he actually volunteered himself as a placement option and said, I'll even take the twin.
That is correct.
And when was that communicated?
One of the arguments that was made to encourage father to consider a voluntary termination was that it would not support separating these children. And
Then I need to have you go back to the approval of his home with mother as a placement. Was that placement conducted with an eye towards both children? I'm just curious. I didn't think of that until now.
I don't know that. I don't represent father at the stage of the proceedings, and the home study itself doesn't clarify that. It found no barriers, so that means that it found that the people who resided in the home were safe and appropriate. It found that there was adequate space in the home, that the home itself was safe, and the conditions in the environment surrounding the home were safe and appropriate for placement.
Well, I don't think you answered my question, though. When was it communicated to social services and the court that he was a placement option for both his own biological child as well as the twin?
I would say it was near the end of, at the time probably the termination petition was filed, because that was the first he had been informed that the children would not be separated, that the agency would not support separating the children.
So it was near the end of, prior to the filing of the termination?
I don't believe
petition.
So.
Since he and his mother's home were not family to that other twin, would it have been a petition to permissible?
Yes, it would have been.
The other father relinquishes parental rights, correct?
That is correct.
And he and mother likewise.
Correct. Mother had terminated at the end of November. The other father was non-available. He didn't participate at all in any of the proceedings, and he was terminated by default. The termination hearing actually initially addressed both of those parents. And so
my point was that your client was not the father of the other twin.
Correct.
So he's not family. Under the statute, could the court have made that kind of placement?
Yes, it could have. It would have required that they further make sure that the home would be licensable. And I would argue that the home study, by finding no barriers to placement, would have satisfied that.
Now, was the Skyping with both twins?
The sister participated because they were in the same home, but it wasn't designed for that. That wasn't made available, and he wasn't asked early in the case if he would be interested. The in-person visits that did occur in February 2019 involved both siblings. And Dr., can I say her name? The experts who observed the visits in this case noted that father was able to manage his time between the two, and that he was calm, and that he was attentive to both of those children.
Here's something else that I've noticed in TPR proceedings and jumped out in here, is there's always this big stamp put on that the children are, the child here in this case was a special needs child. And then when I look into the record, special needs can be like everything, but when I look at it here, it appeared to me that it was whittled down to a lot of behavioral things. So tell me what the special needs were of this child as you understood them to be.
As I understood, they were of a behavioral nature.
Not like it's a physical special needs or...
Correct. And driven by trauma and instability in the child's early years. The evaluation of the child was never provided to my client because he had participant status. And so it wasn't, didn't have an opportunity to even review it until we were preparing for the permanency trial, which were the days he was visiting his children before the trial started.
Well, can I ask you this? Because, since he's a participant, was there ever a case plan developed for him, specific to him?
There was a case plan developed. There was a case plan developed. It's my argument that the case plan, because it was developed in February, was really intended or used as an assessment.
But wasn't that where he had to comply with the law abiding, but yet he didn't have any criminal history and drug tests, but he didn't have any chemical use history, so it was kind of a...
I think he put it correctly. You cut and paste mother's case plan and you put my name on it, because it mirrors almost word for word.
Did he ever sign it?
No, he did not sign it.
And did he indicate to the court that this is inappropriate for me?
Here's what happened. He did not sign it. At the May court hearing, that was the hearing where the court reviewed and approved the case plan. The court, in its own footnote, and I can't recall the page number, says, father did not participate in the hearing because the court did not call him. So he was not afforded any input at all, as a participant or otherwise. He was excluded from that hearing by the court. At the subsequent hearing, which would have been in October of 2018, he essentially says, this is a cutting case for mother, and if I'm going to be expected, if you're going to be doing all of these things, I want legal representation. And the court said, you're not entitled to appointed counsel at this point in the proceedings. That decision of the court is contrary to the law. In child, in case planning, I could just have a minute.
So it was, there was an objection then to the case plan.
There was.
And what did the court do in response to the objection?
Court said that you're not entitled to court-appointed counsel at this stage in the proceedings. The court, it's my argument, as far as that case plan, the court didn't even have authority to order a participant to comply with the case plan. Because in the statute, the court says that once a case plan has been approved or modified after a hearing, the court shall order the parties to comply with the case plan. Because in child protection, we make these distinctions of participants and parties, I think the legislature was very deliberate as to who the court had authority to order.
And he wasn't a party.
He wasn't a party. And it says also that he is statutorily entitled to court-appointed counsel in the development of a case plan. And in October, when he finally had a chance to say, hey, I would like something, the court, contrary to the law, says you're not entitled to appointed counsel at this stage in the proceedings.
Can I guess I'm a little confused too on this, because he was the biological father and had gone through, it was a paternity action.
Correct.
So he was the father.
Yes.
How could he not be a party? I mean, if he has an interest in this child, he's paying child support, right?
Non-custodial parents are afforded participant status. They have the right to intervene as a party, but inasmuch as his rights were not reviewed with him, he would have really, and from Michigan, he would have had no reason to really understand that complex nuance.
One of those kind of flaws, or I shouldn't say flaw, one of the irregularities in appointment of counsel proceedings.
Yes.
Okay, so here's a question that you can address and rebuttal if necessary, but if we agree with you and we reverse, what happens? Or are we reversing and remanding, saying, come up with a plan for him and see if there's reasonable efforts to reunify, that type of thing? What happens?
I think that the decision should be reversed. I think that the child should be turned over to his father, frankly, absent their ability to create a basis for a petition. It's likely that I would see a petition that would say, we need to build the relationship between you and your child and make the transition.
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jennifer Ryan, Assistant Itasca County Attorney, and I represent the respondent in this case.
Can I ask you, first off, I mean, is there ever a time when you make a participant enter into a case plan and obey the case plan? Is there any authority for that, if it's truly a participant situation as opposed to a party?
Well, I would offer that in this particular case, the appellant, was a non-custodial parent without any legal or physical custodial rights. And for non-custodial parents, such as appellant, as I referenced in the brief, reasonable efforts begin with the assessment of the parent's willingness and ability to provide day-to-day care for the child. And Judge Hooten, you had actually elaborated on that, or touched on that in my counsel's comments.
But before we go there, I mean, if a person is truly a participant, does the court and social services have any authority to require that participant, quote unquote, follow a case plan?
Yes, okay. And that is derived from Minnesota Statute 260C.219, paren A, paren 2, paren little I.
But he didn't have a case plan.
Well, there was an out-of-home case plan that was provided to him, yes. The social worker had a conversation with him on February 5th, 2018, and following that conversation, a case plan was created for him.
Eventually, yeah. Now talk about mother's plan, though.
Yes, ma'am. Yes. There was a case plan for a father that was developed in February of 2018, and it was provided to him as well. And again, the purpose of that case plan for him as a non-custodial parent, and in this case,
he didn't meet with the social worker to create that case plan. Right?
They discussed over the telephone, so there are certainly some barriers.
And he objected to some of the stuff in there.
That's right. There was that phone conversation where they were able to identify what some of those needs might be. The social worker then drafted the case plan, and didn't do it with him in the same room, sent it to him, asked him to please call so that they could discuss that case plan.
But, and I want to, because this is, I want to get this straight. Once he's part of a case plan, does that make him a party at that point? Because the only reason to give a parent a case plan is so that they can be reunified with the child. Why would you have just a participant be part of a case plan if there's, if they don't have an interest?
And pursuant to that concurrent planning, first to answer your first question,
okay.
No, a case plan does not automatically then trigger that they have a different status within that child protection case, but rather the out-of-home placement plan is derived to assist that parent in providing that day-to-day care, and also it's part of the concurrent planning, so that if reunification with the mother fails, we've got a solid backup.
But again, you're giving the case plan to this participant, And once this participant, I mean, and one of the arguments you're making is they didn't do what they were supposed to do under this case plan, and therefore their rights were terminated. How can they not be a party if that's the end result? I guess, you see what I'm saying?
Well, I would submit to the court that the rights to the appellant were provided to him in the summons that he received that was completed through personal service. It's the best type of service that we have. And certainly,
at that point in time, had the mother's parental rights already been terminated?
I was referring to the child protection case plan initially. So no, the mother's parental rights had not been terminated at that
point. At the point that there was discussion about a case plan for him, had mother's parental rights been terminated?
No. The child went into out-of-home placement in December of 2017. The conversation, I believe mother admitted the CHIPS petition in January of 2018, and the father was had those initial discussions with the social worker on February 5, 2018, to talk about some of the things that he may need to do.
So when were mother and parental rights terminated?
I believe November 2018.
And when was father presented with those cases?
Late February 2018. Yes, that was approximately 9 months prior to the termination of parental rights. And what we're trying to do in these child
parental rights of the mother.
Yes.
And but was he advised at the time that he was presented with this case plan that if he didn't follow the case plan that his rights would be terminated?
Certainly, yes. Included in the respondent's brief, there are numerous sites to when the social worker and the court had encouraged respondent, or the appellant's father, to come to Minnesota to visit his child to establish a relationship in the event that reunification with mother was not possible. And so,
okay, so one time he was coming, there's a snowstorm and the plane gets canceled, right?
That was the testimony.
And then we have to accept the fact that it's kind of hype to get to northern Minnesota when you fly into Minneapolis, St. Paul, you have to rent a car. These are big obstacles. We're talking about young people that perhaps don't understand what the legal applications, and if you don't have reliable transportation, that's a long run.
And the agency did recognize that. However, the appellant was able to come to Minnesota.
Was there any reason the child couldn't go to see him? I mean, it seems to me it would almost be easier if the child would have went there and they're taking a look at the home.
So the agency certainly has to provide reasonable efforts, but they are just that, at reasonable efforts. To subject the child at the time, who was 4 years old, to a 13-hour car ride one way for a visit for a parent.
So you're taking a 20-something kid, has cars that at that time I understood were kind of not reliable, who does need to take a plane, which means he's got to rent a car and then drive to someplace. I mean,
And miss work,
and you don't have any money.
Well, the agency did pay for not only hotel, the agency paid for gas.
How do you do that if you're working around the work schedule?
And as indicated in the, he was employed at the outset of the case, but from October 2018 through January 2019, anywhere from a 2 to 4 month period of time, it was not elicited exactly if it was the beginning of October 2018 or the end, and similarly when his new employment began. But there was
graduate hotels. Didn't he say he had some training program or something he had to go through?
But there was a 2 to 4 month period of time, depending on, you know, how big that gap was. But even assuming if it was 2 months, he had no employment during at least a 60-day window when he could have made his child a priority, but he chose not to. Even though the agency had offered many times to provide him with food, to provide him with funds for travel, to provide him with gas cards, hotel stays. This goes even beyond reasonable efforts. And I would also like to point out that the appellant was able to come to Minnesota, conceive a child, find his way back to the state of Michigan. When he was notified that he had a child in those paternity proceedings in 2016, the district court called him. They tried to engage him and talk about custody and parenting time, things of that nature. He chose to hang up. He indicated that he didn't want
anything. Well, there is a little bit of a surprise when you're told that you're the father of the child and there's a twin, but you're not the father of the other, you kind of have to grasp with reality here.
That's right, and so there was additional genetic testing done. He did have the opportunity to have court-appointed counsel in that matter as well. So it wasn't as if he's some 20-year-old, child going this alone. He had representation as well. And then when he learned that his child was then subject to the jurisdiction of the juvenile court and encouraged to come to Minnesota to develop a relationship with his child, he again chose not to make his child a priority. And there's limits on what the agency...
What was the basis for the trial court denying him counsel in the first proceeding?
I don't know. I don't know that a request was ever made, a formal request. I don't know that an application was ever, filled out. Certainly there has to be an application for one to determine that they're even eligible financially for a court-appointed attorney. I did note in my review, it does not appear that transcripts from every hearing were requested or obtained, and so I don't know. And then in the reasonable efforts that the agency had to provide, not only did the district court encourage, contact with the social worker and to come to Minnesota to meet the child, the social worker did the same. And there were various types of communication that we attempted to reach out to the appellant. Communication came in the form of phone calls, text messages, certified letters, as well as emails. And the record indicates that there were at least 8 emails that were unopened. Certified mail was sent, there was a letter sent in July of 2018 trying to reach out to the appellant, notifying him of what's expected of him, the services that were available, as well as the needs of his child.
What was that?
That was July of 2018. The letter was sent by certified mail.
First time he had face-to-face was in February 2019.
That's right, 432 days after the child's out-of-home placement. Also, it was 7 days before the termination of parental rights trial. And so that letter in July of 2018, as the district court found, if he would have paid attention to those letters, he would have known about the services available to him, the expectations that the county had of him, as well as the needs of his child. That letter in July of 2018 was sent by certified mail. On certified mail, a delivery was attempted 3 times. And if you look at Exhibit 18 from the trial court trial, you'll notice that there were 3 specific dates that delivery was attempted. He did not pick it up. That letter was resent in the month of August of 2018. Similarly, he failed to pick up the letter after 3 service attempts. Another letter was sent to him in October of 2018. His mother signed for the letter, and appellant even admitted at trial that his mother signed for the letter, gave it to him, but he failed to pick it up, or he failed to read it. He failed to open the mail. There's limits on what the agency can realistically do. We can do reasonable efforts, but we can't force somebody.
What was it about his conduct that made him that met the statutory requirements for termination here?
So
what is it about him as a father that made him unfit or?
Sure. So at the beginning of the case, he was not a caregiver for the child.
So if I can sum it up, what you're saying, your biggest thing is he just disregarded taking on a role as dad.
That's right. He did not evidence any intention to parent this child.
He himself doesn't have a chemical dependency issue, doesn't have psychological issues, isn't in jail or criminal issues. But the big thing is he just kind of ducked.
Well, even that is arguable. So he did not identify that he had any chemical dependency issues. This child came from an environment where the child was subjected to drug use. And so what we like to do is, talk to the non-custodial parents, see if there's any of these issues. Let's get in on the front end. Identify if there's any needs, in this case, submit to a UA. If there is a positive test, then do a chemical dependency evaluation and follow the recommendations.
Really, it also follows suit, though, that if that's the environment that was here, that may have been a very real reason you stay away from that environment because you don't want to be a part of that environment.
Well, and I think it's important to offer a parent at the beginning, at the front end, in this particular case, services to treat any potential deficits so that if we get to the point where reunification with mother is not successful, we have a non-custodial parent ready, in the wings, ready to take the child into his home. Rather than, the alternative is, at month 10, at month 11, we discover that you've got some, you know, chemical dependency issues that now are untreated. And when we look at...
Why wasn't he asked if he just voluntarily terminated back when he wanted nothing to do with it?
In 2016.
So I sort of feel like, okay, you have child support obligations, we want to keep you as a parent, but then we don't want to bring you on as a parent because then we won't have child support, but if you're not being involved with your child, then we should terminate your parental rights. I mean, it just, to me, this, it just seems so cyclical in terms of how you entice a parent to be a parent. That is not a question, that's a statement. Very
honorable,
thank you.
Well, but I would offer that the condition at the time that the child protection case began, appellant was not a parent. He had no relationship with the child and could not meet the child's daily needs. And that condition continued to exist.
All right, because I know that there was testimony in the record that he did try to get some relationship with the child, but the mother said, well, you can do that, but you're going to have sex with me. And that was his testimony, and he didn't want to go there again. So what, I mean, was there anything to contest that? Or, I mean, and that he did make an attempt, but he, you know, was thwarted by mother?
I'm not aware of any active efforts that he actually took other than what was stated in the record. Okay. However, I do know that there was a paternity file, that he filed no motions to establish any sort of custody or parenting time assistance. You know, certainly those are court forms that are available on the judicial website and are accessible even with an informal papyrus, you know, to fill out for someone who is low income, and really like a do-it-yourself form to avail himself of court resources.
Did he pay his child support?
There is record in the file that he was paying. I'm not sure if there were nominal arrears or not. My recollection of reading the transcripts, there wasn't much elaborated on.
But it wasn't, there's nothing in the record that showed it was an issue.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think the real intent of the agency and the court in this case is summarized on page 6 of 11 of the case plan, which identifies what is the primary permanency plan for this child and what is the concurrent permanency plan for this child. The primary plan is reunification, which we know goes to the parent who had legal custody at the time of removal or the legal custodian, that is mother. What is the concurrent plan? Adoption. If father was ever considered a concurrent permanency option, which is the appropriate consideration for non-custodial parents, he would have been in here in the plan, and the plan would have been a permanent transfer of custody to a non-custodial parent. This was what was recommended to the court and written and provided to my client, to father, in February of 2018. And it's what was approved by the court in May of 2018 when the court did not bother to call him to have any discussions with regards to this case plan. He was not a part of this.
Again, did the court know that he had made himself available as a placement option?
Yes.
In February of 2018?
He had said that from the beginning, that he wanted his son with him, and the response, and that response carried through in the admit deny, it carried through in the May hearing, which is, Your Honor, we know that that's difficult because we're focusing on reunification with mother. The child needs to remain in Minnesota. He did not, under 1B5, contribute to the conditions that resulted in the placement of the child, and in 1B2, he did not contribute to the conditions that formed the basis of the petition. As far as the authority of the court with regards to the case plan, I would reference this court to 260C.201, subdivision 7C. The court shall approve the case plan as presented or modify it after hearing from the parties. Once the plan is approved, the court shall order all parties to comply with it. He is entitled to appointed representation in the development of the case plan.
So as a point of law, once they submitted that case plan to him, by virtue of the law, he became a party?
Correct. Okay. And under 260C.212 subdivision 1D, The parent shall have the right to legal counsel in the preparation of the case plan and shall be informed of that right at the time of placement of the child. If unable to employ counsel from their own resources, the court shall appoint counsel upon the request of a parent. That is what he was denied in October when he asked for it.
Did he make a formal written request for counsel?
He made an oral request on the record. Understand, he qualified for court-appointed counsel for the permanency proceedings. Typically, a court would say you need to fill out an application. The court didn't even afford him that opportunity. He just said you're not entitled at this point in the proceedings. Under the two statutory bases that are raised to support this termination of parental rights, neither can result in a termination of father's parental rights in this case. Absent the ability to show that he contributed to the conditions that formed the basis of the petition, which he did not, there are no amendments to the petition, and I would argue, had it been amended to father, he would have been made a party at that time. That did not happen. With regards to the placement of the child, those were leading to the placement of the child were the conditions and the actions of mother, and the continuation of that placement was to afford reunification with mother under a case plan recommended by the agency, approved by the court, that never considered him as a parent for his child, ever. This decision needs to be reversed.
All right, thank you very much. The case was very well presented, and we will take the matter under advisement and issue the decision within the shortened period of time.
Thank you.